Good evening y bienvenidos a Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. I'm Alex Hernandez of Noticias Univision Chicago. We cherish every weekday morning at 5 and 6. Thank you for sharing part of your weekend with us on the show tonight. Some Illinois employers will soon have to give their workers more paid days off. A look at the impact on employees and small businesses. Illinois residents lead the nation in filing applications for student debt relief. What's at stake as the Supreme Court debates the future of forgiveness? Mayoral candidate Paul Vallis plans to boost development takes a page from Lori Lightfoot. Enjoy the rhythm of the sea at an upcoming event at the Shedd Aquarium.
This food is just as serious as anything that's out there, so let's talk about it and let's cook it.
And next up in our On the Pass series, Chef Mark Mendez offers his hot takes on the seriousness of Latin cuisine. All that coming up, but our first story tonight, Illinois workers set to receive more pay days off. How it works, right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Nearly all workers will soon be guaranteed paid leave for any reason here in Illinois. Employers in the state will be required to offer workers a minimum of 5 days of paid time off based on hours worked. 1 hour of paid leave is earned for every 40 hours worked. The law goes into effect next year. Joining us now with more are Jose Uribe, Workplace Justice Campaigns Organizer at Arise Chicago, and Jill Manrique, co-director of Chicago Jobs with Justice. I want to welcome both for joining us. Thank you for being here, but I want to start with you, Jose. I know ladies first, but
it's okay.
We'll make an exception this time, right? Jose, can you give us more of an idea of what this new law does?
Of course, yes. Thank you. Happy to join you tonight, Alex. So this new Paid Leave Act is going to be going into effect this upcoming year on January 1st, 2024. And you've laid out some good background as to what it's going to look like. So workers will be eligible to gain up to 1 hour of leave time for every 40 hours worked. One detail I will add to that is that this includes overtime. So where you have workers that regularly work in excess of 40 hours a week, that would go toward their accumulation and annual cap of 40 hours a year. Another important part of this legislation is that it does include domestic workers as well.
Even them working part-time, so they could accumulate those 40 hours.
That is correct.
It's about the 40 hours.
Yep. So it's based on 1 hour of accumulation for every 40 worked. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're only working half-time, 20 hours a week. You would accumulate half an hour a week.
Okay.
Yes.
Good point. Great point. Jill, how do you think this will impact workers, especially Latino workers?
Thank you for the question, and thank you for having us, Alex. Well, we know that our Latino community makes up a huge part of the workforce. And if we look just as recently as COVID, we could see that our community was also hugely impacted by COVID, along with the Black community. And that, in along with other opportunities and resources that are not accessible to our community, not having paid leave had a huge impact on the numbers of fatalities and illnesses within our community. So just imagine if this opportunity was out there before that.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely would change a lot of things.
Absolutely.
Jose, you've already gotten some confused reaction from some workers about how the law will work. What issues do you see arising in how this law will actually play out once it takes effect?
Sure. Well, as far as the confusion that's arisen up to this point is around laws that currently exist, right? So specifically in Cook County and in the city of Chicago proper, there are ordinances that talk about paid sick leave. And so the new law is covering workers who are working outside of those two areas and deals with paid leave without any reason for justification, right? So it's not just that you have to confirm that you are out sick, but you could be out for really any reason you wish to be out without having to provide some kind of letter from the doctor or something saying that you're out for an express reason. Yes. And so the confusion comes in so far as you know, workers are calling me at Arise Chicago saying, oh, you know, I'm thrilled to hear that I'm going to get a week of vacation on top of a week of paid sick leave.
Okay.
And so if we go back to the new law that's going into effect January 1st, it talks about 40 hours annually of paid leave time for mixed purposes. So this would include everything from, you know, you have to show up in court, you want to take a vacation day, you're out sick. So those 5 days, you could find yourself moving through them pretty quickly if, you know, you take vacation.
That's a great point. So it includes sick days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Jill, many of the workers that your organization deal with fall under the excluded worker category. Mm-hmm. Could you talk more about who these workers are?
Sure. So these are workers who aren't in a traditional workplace. So specifically in our organization, we work alongside other organizations to organize and fight for the rights of, for instance, app workers, rideshare drivers, street vendors, workers like that.
Okay. Actually, another point of concern is how this will disproportionately impact small businesses. We spoke with Chris Davis, who heads the National Federation of Independent Businesses Illinois chapter, earlier this week. Let's take a listen.
Small business owners have very limited resources and very few employees to cover shifts and to make sure that they can service their customers and clients in times of need as well. That's the burden on small businesses, is tracking those hours and ensuring that they have documented what time off is available to their employees.
Jose, what's your reaction to how this will impact Latino-owned small businesses?
It's a concern we hear a lot, right? The idea that new laws could have a negative impact on businesses. And I think what bears mentioning is the fact that there are costs associated with things like staff retention. Not to mention, you know, if you're a consumer visiting a business, you want to go there with full confidence that personnel are treated properly, are not being made to show up sick, and that, you know, you are making an ethical decision in patronizing that business. So, you know, from where we're sitting, I think that the business community stands to greatly benefit, as do all working people in the state of Illinois with this new law.
Jill, same question. How do you think it will impact small businesses?
Well, I know personally that everywhere that I've worked that actually treated me as a whole human, I've given more of myself to. I've made sure to show up on time and regularly to, and I get a sense of dedication to making sure they're successful. And in our business, on top of that, we also, we believe in people over profit. And if you're putting your people first, that's going to mean nothing but success for businesses.
Definitely. Jose, as a campaign organizer, what would you be looking for as we see this bill eventually go into effect? What would you be looking for as a campaign organizer as this law goes into effect, like to protect the workers?
I see. Sure. So any law, in order to be truly effective, is going to have safeguards and dedicated funding in place for enforcement. You know, obviously it's wonderful to see the state effecting and enacting new laws, but where we lack the resources to effectively enforce those laws, they don't really have the same impact that is intended in the community, right? So a lot of laws right now are structured around the complaint-based enforcement, and we would welcome, you know, a transition into more proactive means and also a collaborative approach between, you know, government and local organizations like Jobs with Justice, Arise Chicago, in ensuring that workers are not falling through the cracks.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Jose Uribe and Jill Manrique. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, why Illinois leads the nation on student debt relief applications. The state of Illinois leads the nation in applications for student loan debt relief. More than 1.5 million residents applied for loan forgiveness before President Joe Biden's plan was put on hold amid legal challenges. The plan's fate is now in the hands of the Supreme Court, which just heard arguments on the case. If upheld, millions of borrowers across the country would stand to benefit, including many Latinos. 67% of Latino student borrowers have educational debt. Due to that debt, 33% put off getting married, and 37% report waiting longer to have children. And listen to this. Latinos are also more likely to default on their student loans than white students. Joining us now with more are Tierre Diaz, Success Program Director at Bottom Line Chicago, and Horacio Mendez, President and CEO of the Woodstock Institute. I want to welcome both for joining us today, but I'm going to start with you, Horacio. Thank you for being here. According to the U.S. Department of Education data, Illinois leads the nation in applications for student debt relief. It's also number 7 in the nation for outstanding student debt. Do you think those numbers tell us anything about the state of Illinois?
Well, it tells us a couple of different things, some good and some bad. First and foremost, with regard to the efforts by an amazing cadre of nonprofits throughout Illinois to be able to get the word out, partnerships with the education system, colleges really being forward in terms of making sure that people know what their rights are when this comes through. I've seen that, and I travel quite a bit, and I moved here a couple of years ago from California, and I have gone back. I've noticed much more effort in Illinois to be able to get people educated about this than I have in some of the other states I've been at. So that's a positive. With regard to the sheer numbers and its impact on Latinos, you know, we have a very strong culture as it relates to money and debt. And it's worked in our favor in the areas of debt burden and borrowing for school for quite some time. It may take longer. It might take a difficult balance between work and school, but Latinos are doing a really good job. Like you said, 67% of Latino college students got federal loans, but that's compared to 76% for Black students. Mm-hmm. The average amount of debt for Latinos was $24,000 compared to $32,000 for Black students, and even lower than the average of $25,000 for white borrowers. Even the percentage of adults with student loan debt was lower for Latinos at 14% compared to Black adults at 30% and white adults at 20%. But the trends aren't great. So we need to keep an eye on that because, unfortunately, the sheer volume of debt is growing really fast. And for Latinos, from 2004 to 2016, I think, it jumped 60%. So we need to watch that. And there's a much deeper systemic issue we need to address.
Tierre, what barriers to financing their education do students you work with face?
Thank you so much for having me here. So there are a number of barriers that our students are facing when it comes to accessing critical funds that they need to fund their education. I think first and foremost, the process itself is pretty robust, and some of our students are lacking the critical guidance and support within schools and in communities to really understand the whole financial aid process and really have the financial knowledge that they need to make critical decisions about where they're planning on going to school.
Horacio, we heard in the intro that Latinos with student debt are making actually big decisions with their student debt in mind. What kind of an effect does student debt have on building wealth for Latinos?
Well, it's basically when you think about the pile of systemic inequities that Latinos have to deal with, you're adding things like the wealth and income gap, barriers that are faced in achieving home ownership or starting a business. It ends up basically acting as a wealth tax. It wasn't too long ago that the burden of education was on our government to invest in young people and to invest in communities. And that burden over the years has transitioned to families and individuals with very little support, making it even harder than it already was to create real pathways to home ownership, to start a business, to be able to save for retirement or college for your kids.
Tierre, how does Bottom Line work actually with students to minimize educational debt?
Absolutely. So I think our first approach is really just in supporting students and their families in building that financial knowledge that they need to really understand the system and have a full understanding of the impact that this is going to have on their financial futures. So we take sort of a two-tier approach. I'd say the first approach is proactive. We work with students who are in high school preparing to make that college choice to really understand what the cost of attending attendance is and what their options are. I think with public discourse on loans, there are certainly a lot of fears regarding loans. And there are also a lack of resources regarding alternative plans to pay. And so our role is really just to ensure that students understand which institutions are the best fit for them financially, but are also aligned with our academic and career goals. And then I would say the next step is supporting students once they're already in college. This is a prolonged effort. Financial barriers continuously come up within a student's educational career. And so we work with students one-on-one to ensure that they have a plan to pay for school in a way that really reduces debt as much as possible.
Right. We are cutting it short on time here, Horacio, but I'm going to go with you with the last question. We have less than a minute. How do you think the U.S. actually compares to other nations in the approach of paying off for student loan debt?
Well, depending on how short a time you have, it could be not well, period. If you take an honest look at what the United States needs to complete at the global level, the income base we need to sustain Social Security, our streets, our schools, it all boils down to an educated workforce, and high school doesn't get us there. We need to recalibrate and have the same conversation we had as a country in the 1800s when we came to the same conclusion and made education through high school a right, not a commodity to be sold to the highest bidder, which is what we're dealing with right now.
Wow. Thank you so much, Horacio Mendez and Tierra Diaz, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Up next, candidates for mayor and their plans for boosting development in Chicago. Parachutes with that story right after this.
Crime and public safety aren't the only issues facing Paul Vallas and Brandon Johnson in the race for Chicago mayor. Both candidates also face questions about how they would boost development on the south and west sides. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now for a look at Vallas' plan, which takes a page from soon-to-be former mayor Lori Lightfoot. All right, Heather, Vallas and Johnson say they want to continue direct investments to the south and west side. Vallas says he's going to take a much different approach than Johnson. What is that different approach?
Vallas has proposed creating an independent community development authority, and he says that that agency will operate free of politics from the fifth floor, that's the mayor's office, and aldermanic prerogative, which of course is the unwritten rule that gives every alderperson the final say on what happens in that ward. Now, even though his economic development plan runs nearly 1,500 words, it's not quite clear how this body would work, what authority it would have, and how much money it would cost to staff up a whole new city agency. The Vallas campaign did not respond to our requests for additional information.
Right. Typically with these kinds of boards, if the mayor is appointing the board members, the mayor still kind of de facto has control over it. So why does Vallas think that this new approach is needed?
Well, he acknowledges the South and the West Side have endured decades of disinvestment, and he says that this body will leverage the city's resources, and not just its annual budget, but the sister agency budgets and its ability to borrow to really make a difference in communities where there are very many vacant land, and of course that contributes to crime and traps families in generations of poverty.
All right, so this kind of gets at the whole issue of aldermanic prerogative, where if there's a development in a certain ward, that alderman usually has the final say, and all other council members defer to that alderman. Lightfoot promised to end that in her campaign and in her tenure as mayor. We know how that kind of soured relationships. So what kind of support is there for something like this with Paul Vallas and Enta Alderman having the final say on this?
So there's very little appetite on the city council to tackle this hot button issue again. It's really hard to overstate how bruising these battles were on the city council. And there's a reason why Lori Lightfoot will leave office with aldermanic prerogative intact, if a little weakened.
So if Vallas's push to scale back aldermanic prerogative falters, what happens to this issue for whoever the next mayor is?
Well, the biggest threat to aldermanic prerogative is likely an ongoing federal probe, which stems from a 2018 complaint from community groups who said that this practice really prevents affordable housing from being built in white areas of the city. And that could trigger an action by the Housing and Urban Development Department, but we'll have to wait and see.
All right, Heather Sharon, just one of the many hot button issues that you are following in this race. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Paris.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website, WTTW.com/news. Back with more Chicago Tonight Latino Voices right after this.
Do you like a little salsa with your fish? Well, at the Shedd Aquarium next week, Ritmo del Mar will put some Latin music, cuisine, and culture alongside the Shedd's famed Under the Sea exhibits.
Ritmo del Mar is an evening event at Shedd, one of our after hours series. It's an opportunity for us to showcase some amazing musical talent and blend some cultural elements. We're going to have two marvelous bands, Carpaccio y su Super Combo, as well as Proyecto 7. They'll be performing in two different locations here in the building. We're also going to have Mayambo Dance Company doing some dance instruction, as well as just some dancing on their own. Blending that with some marvelous cuisine, including ropa vieja and hibiscus margarita, some wonderful desserts, tres leches, along with some other dessert options. So a blend to thrill the senses. So events like this, it's an opportunity to give people a new reason to come to Shedd Aquarium, to engage more deeply. It's a chance to invite different audiences, and at our heart is always our mission, which is to inspire compassion, curiosity, and conservation for the aquatic animal world. And by having a wonderful experience that people associate great times with these animals, that's going to make them even more stronger and greater ambassadors out in the world. We love welcoming all to Shedd. We're super excited to have people come, have a great time, have some drinks, have some food, take in some beautiful animals, and maybe make some new friends.
That sounds like fun, actually. You'll find more information about tickets for Ritmo del Mar on our website. We're not done yet. The colors and flavors of Latino cuisine can be found all over Chicago now, but it hasn't always been considered worthy of fine dining. Chef Mark Mendez of Skokie's Libertad restaurant says Latino cuisine deserves a spot among the world's great culinary traditions. He's next up in our series On the Pass.
This food is just as serious as anything that's out there. So let's talk about it and let's cook it and let's show people how serious we can be. When I grew up, my house was kind of like I Love Lucy, which I don't know if anybody even knows what I Love Lucy is anymore. So my father's Puerto Rican, and my mother was from downstate Illinois. So my father said, if we're going to get married, you have to know how to cook Puerto Rican food, right? So you have to know how to make tostones, arroz con gandules, pasteles, everything. You have to know how to do it. So they went to Puerto Rico. My grandmother taught her how to make Puerto Rican food, and then she came back, and then they got married, right? There should be a spice level. It doesn't have to be spicy. There should be something there. It should be bright colored, I feel like. It should be alive, you know. There should be a lot of acid. Let's hit all these notes, you know, because this is what Latin American food is. The French and Italian can do whatever they want, you know, and I feel like we should do what we want, too. Other chefs that I respected, I said, okay, these guys are going to the market. Why are they going? I just was curious. And I remember going with the attitude, I remember saying to one of my sous chefs, I'm like, how different can it be? Like, a carrot's a carrot, man. Like, I remember saying the exact word, like, a carrot's a carrot. Like, what's, come on. And then when I got there, I remember trying one of the farmer's arugula, and my head exploded, because I was like, I've never tasted anything like this in my life. During the summer, when there's so many things in season, I always go overboard. I always say that I'm not, and I always do. I always buy way too many tomatoes or peppers or chilies. It's summer, man. Like, get it while you have it, and then it's gone. So we had this kale salad on the menu at my restaurant, and I hated it. I hated it just because this is how chefs are, okay? I'm going to give you an insight on what chefs are like. It sold like crazy, so of course I hated it, right? So I wanted to take it off. And she was like, you know, Mark, people really like that salad. And I was like, yeah, I don't care. I'm the chef. I'm going to do what I want. Right? And then we took it off the menu, and people were, to say they were upset was like really not even coming close. And then I got to thinking about it. I'm like, oh, what did I do? Like, what did I do? Like, why did I do that? And, you know, I should just listen to her in the first place. He's an executive chef at Purple Pig, And when I started this project, he was a kid. Like, I was young, but he was younger. But he'd been there longer, and he kind of showed me the ropes. He really helped me. I mean, he was hard on me, but it was in a good way. And he really helped me learn those skills you need as a cook to, like, survive, right? He's a great cook, good chef. But it's not just him, right? It's like, how many cooks have showed me how to do something in 32 years, right?
All those dishes look amazing. We'll get the hot dish from Chef Effie Medrano in our next edition of On the Pass. Well, that's going to do it for this weekend. If you're watching us on Saturday night, know that you can also catch Latino Voices and Black Voices on Sundays beginning at 10 p.m. Also, don't forget to tune in to Noticias Univision Chicago every weekday morning. I'll be waiting for you early at 5 and 6. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, I'm Alex Hernandez. Thank you for sharing part of your weekend with us. Muy buenas noches. Have a good one.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm dedicated to preserving the dignity and rights of all individuals.